About 15 minutes ago, I fell asleep. About 5 minutes ago, I woke up. So, I just need a minute to... Yes, well, the Buddha began his teachings with the way things are in the most obvious and easily verified ways. We get old, we get sick, we die. And we see right from the very beginning how brilliant a teacher the Lord Buddha was. As the Lord Buddha had abandoned the path of asceticism, the five disciples weren't very happy about it. As in those days, there seemed to be two choices. You could lead the household life, the life focused on survival for the poorest people, and then more and more on enjoyment of sensual pleasures as you got more wealthy. It was one path. The other path was the path of asceticism. So when the Buddha abandoned the path of asceticism, the five disciples assumed, of course, that he was going to return to the life in the palace. And they were pointing, oh, right, for him, you know, he just goes straight back where he left off, a life of leisure, enjoyment, luxury. What about us? We don't have that kind of future to look forward to at all. We gave it all up. So a little bit peeved. So the Buddha walks all the way to Sarnath, walks into the deer's park, and they see the Buddha, and they said, don't show any respect for him. Just act cool. Just act normal. How could he do that to us? But then as the Buddha approaches, they can't help themselves, you know, just go out and receive him and look after him. But they haven't forgiven him yet. And then when the Buddha speaks, and this is the brilliance of it, the Buddha says that the household life, the life of sensual pleasures, is low and ignoble, a dead end, waste of time. And you can imagine them all breathing a sigh of relief, you know, oh, he's come to his senses. He realizes he's made a mistake. He's come back to take over. But then the Buddha says the life of asceticism is a cul-de-sac. It's a dead end. It's a waste of time. It's ignoble. And then you can imagine they're completely confused. Hold on, just a minute. You said the sensual indulgence is wrong. Now you're saying asceticism is wrong. Look, where are you going with this? And it's that point that the Buddha teaches the Eightfold Path, the middle way. So recognizing that if the Buddha, fully enlightened Buddha as he was, if he'd launched into the Eightfold Path right at the beginning of the discourse, then it's quite likely they would have rejected what he had to say. I mean, this is my speculation. But the fact that he realized that the readiness of the listener is vital, that the listener has to be interested, has to want to listen. What's he going to say next? And how can this be? There's only two choices, and then the Buddha says there's a third choice. It's a middle way. The Buddha was always very aware of the state of mind of the listener. I think it's fair to say that his teaching career began with a failure, because this is actually not the first teaching. The first teaching is when he's walking to Sarnath and he meets this ascetic or some religious figure of some kind, whose name I can't remember. You see, if he'd have been more receptive, I'd have remembered his name. He'd have gone down in history, the fool. So And so he said, "Who are you?" And he says, "And it was, I'm the Buddha, fully enlightened Buddha." And he said, "Yeah, maybe, maybe not." And so this was a failure. I mean, the Buddha didn't enlighten the first person he met on the road. And because he just assumed that it was obvious, you know, "Look at me, I'm the Buddha." The guy said, "Yeah, maybe, maybe not." And the Buddha gave this, by the time he got to Sarnath, you see, the Buddha was the consummate learner. He was ready to adapt the teaching and find a way of getting through to these five ascetics. And at the end of the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, and this sutta is interesting in many ways. I mean, the Buddha talks about the five khandhas in this sutta, so where does that come from? I mean, he doesn't explain what they are. Does that mean that they're already terms in common parlance amongst spiritual seekers? Or does it mean that the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta is in fact what we have now is, and this is my view, is a kind of a summary. In fact, the Buddha probably spent hours talking to them. Or what we have now, we can chant in a very, very short period if you omit all the details about the devas of all the various realms rejoicing. The actual Dhamma teaching is very short. So my guess, it's more of a summary. Anyway, this is how the whole of the Buddha Dhamma starts, the great wheel starts to roll. And the first stream enterer in this Buddhist dispensation appears, Venerable Anya Kondanya. And what is the essence of the earth-shaking insight that he gains from this talk? Everything that is nature to arise passes away. You think, is that all? You know, really? That's all you need to know? Doesn't seem like very much, does it? All that arises passes away. Yeah, I could say my mum knows that. I mean, it's kind of normal. But this is the point that the most revolutionary and most radical, the most transformative things that you can learn as a human being can be summarized in clichés. Now, it doesn't necessarily mean that the more profound the realization, the more profound the articulation of it has to be. And this is what we come back to. Everything arises, passes away. So what is the difference between our normal understanding of that term? Who's going to complain? Who's going to argue about that? What's the difference between that and the knowledge of Anya Kondanya? So our path as practitioners, as people following in the footsteps of the Lord Buddha and the Savaka, is to become learners. The Buddha referred to the arahant. One of the epithets of the arahant is aseka pugala. It means the graduate. And then the sotapanna, the sakadigami, the anagami, they are the seka pugalas. They're the learners. So then where does that leave everyone else? You know, everyone else is like learning how to learn. You know, you don't even become a learner until you're a sotapanna. So we're learning how to learn. So that's what practice is, learning how to learn. And we don't know how to learn as yet. And observation is learning how to observe. This is key to meditation. What's going on here? What happens? What happens when you give yourself the most simple of tasks? When you breathe in, know that you breathe in. When you breathe out, know you breathe out. What happens? How does it feel? As I was mentioning earlier today, the famous words of Lumpu Man, everything is teaching us, but we're all playing truant. We're not really there for it. We're not really learning from what's trying to teach us. We have to be in the classroom of the present moment. So when we start to look more closely at experience, we try to look more closely and learn from experience, and we find the mind sort of like wobbly and unstable. So we have to stabilize the mind. And mindfulness is our path. We develop mindfulness, a beginning and analogy, which is favored by Lumpur Cha. The moments of mindfulness are like drops of water from a tap. It's like drip, drip, drip. So the drips are the mindfulness, and the gaps between the drips are the lapses of mindfulness. And then as you carry on, then the mindfulness becomes more joined up. You get drip, 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 until finally you get a stream of water, a stream of mindfulness. And that's what we call samadhi. So the link between the relationship between sati, mindfulness, and samadhi is very straightforward. A stream of uninterrupted stream of mindfulness is samadhi. So why do we want samadhi? Well, firstly, samadhi proves certain things to us that we sort of pay lip service to, or we say makes sense, but we don't really believe. And that is that true happiness lies within. Now, we all hear this from when we're kids. You know, true happiness lies within. Yeah, but when it comes down to it, the crunch, when you have to make choices, you don't really trust that. You can't trust it until you've experienced it for yourself. So in this debate that has consumed Buddhist academics for hundreds of years, this whole question, samatha and vipassana and you know, backwards and forwards, and the idea that there's this sort of the path of samatha and there's the path of vipassana, and they're two different paths. But if you look at what happens if you develop samadhi through concerted, continuous, uninterrupted sati, is that it's quite clear that the quality of the happiness, the bliss of the focused mind, the stabilized, clarified mind, is so far superior to any sensual pleasure. There's no question. It's just not up for debate. And so withdrawing from that samadhi, then one reviews and examines the implications. What does that really mean? It's not just like a one-off thing that happens with your eyes closed. It's the same mind. When you're meditating and you're not meditating, it's still the same mind. So now, you see, you don't have to put all of your hopes, dreams into sensual pleasure. And the acquisition of sensual pleasure is the protection of sensual pleasure. You have an alternative, you have a perspective on it. And that means that the neurotic, desperate search for sense pleasures now becomes much weaker. You don't, because you know, yeah, if you can have that pleasure, it's kind of nice, but if you don't, it's not the end of the world, because there's something far better that you can access through meditation. So the crucial change that takes place here with regard to your relationship to the sensual world is that you know. You don't just believe and wish. You know there is an alternative to amisa sukha. There is an alternative to sensual pleasure. And it's not something you have to create, but it's something that appears naturally when you remove everything that is concealing it and covering it over. Seeing that, then your values change. Your way of life will probably change in a certain way. And that is a movement of wisdom. You start to lead your life more wisely through reviewing the implications, the meaning of the experience of samadhi, what that means for your life and your values and who you are. Well, this is an example where we can see that there's no clear distinction between the path of samatha and the path of wisdom, because every experience in meditation is telling you something, is teaching you something about who you are or who you are not. So when we close our eyes, meditation, focusing on the in-breath, the out-breath, what do we notice? What do we learn? Well, your sense of yourself as a separate individual entity disappears immediately. What's your name or personality, your gender? It's not there anymore. It's just the real world. And this term, the real world, is just tossed around in such a cavalier fashion, isn't it? People say, oh yeah, he's went on a meditation retreat for a few days and now he's gone back to the real world. People sort of hijack this term, the real world, as if they know what it means. But how do we say, what's the real world? The real world is the world that you can experience directly, free through the mediation of concepts and ideas and beliefs. So you're looking at your in-breath and you're, that's the real world. That's not a fantasy world. That's not escape from the real world. That's the real world, what you can directly experience. And it's teaching you new stuff. Because the more you leave behind all these ideas and beliefs and perceptions about you being this person and that person, the more wonderful it is. And we're living in a world and in a culture where everyone's just sort of shouting out, look at me, whereas this is the look at me generation. And we're all unique. It's just like, you are unique. Yeah, so what? What's so great about that? I mean, we're all unique, like QR codes are unique. Yeah, it's as meaningful as that. Why make a big fuss about it? It's much more interesting to see in the ways we're not unique. You know, because in the real world, it's not even that idea of being unique or being. It's just this. It's just breath coming in, breath coming out. This feeling. Every breath is a feeling or a feeling tone, pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. There's perception. There's memory. There's thought. Yes, and what are all these things doing? You know, it's kind of variety and diversity of stuff, but they're all doing the same thing. They're arising and they're passing away. That's it. Oh, and this anya kundanya. Whatever arises passes away. So yes, you should be in the present moment, abandon the past and the future. Be in the present moment. What does that mean? What is the past? Well, the past is memory, isn't it? You know, whether you can remember past lives or your memory of last year or yesterday, all the past is in the real world is a memory that arises and passes away. What's the future? Well, the future is a thought. And whether it's tomorrow or next year or next lifetime, when we say we're caught in the future, what we're meaning is caught in a thought. So memory, so the past is memory and the future is thought. So being in the present moment means that you know memory as memory and you know thought as thought. Memory arises and passes away, thought arises and passes away. The knowing of memory arising and passes away, arises and passes away. So just looking and learning. And there's this accumulation of looking and learning. It's sort of these conclusions and observations become clearer and clearer. So you be in the present moment doesn't mean there's absolutely no memory in the mind. You have to remember, you have to recollect your meditation structure, for instance. You being in the present moment doesn't preclude thoughts of the future. When you're outside of a meditation cushion, you have to be prioritizing, you have to decide you're going to do this, you're going to do that. Even arahants have to book their plane tickets in advance. They can't, it's just obvious, isn't it, when you think about it? So being in the present moment doesn't mean no past, because past is memory. Doesn't mean no future, because future is thought. But it means that you know memory as memory, and you know thought as thought, and they arise and pass away. So another thing we hear about, like, everything's connected. It's just one vast web of connections. Like, so what? That's not really the point. That doesn't really help matters. What we're interested in is how exactly things are connected, specifically how they're connected. Not just that everything's connected, it's kind of reassuring unity, oneness. But we're saying, how do things arise? What are the causes and conditions for things to arise? What are the causes and conditions for them to be, to exist and to continue? What are the causes and conditions of them passing away? We're interested in understanding this. So we apply effort and we see what happens. And everything that occurs, this is feedback. We're learning. If you put too much effort, get tense, maybe you get a headache, too little effort, fall asleep, get distracted. So this is really important feedback on how to adjust effort and find this balance between effort and relaxation, which is atapi, and which leads to samadhi. Oh yeah, we're learning from this. And technique is one part of it, of course, but probably not as big a part as we tend to believe. The element of meditation which is often neglected, I think, is that of right motivation or chanda. So it's not the case that every time you sit down to meditate, you're motivated and you're enthusiastic, and you sometimes, but not all every time. And at the beginning of meditation, we need to just check the strength of the motivation. And if we feel a little bit like, oh, it's time to meditate, or it's kind of perfunctory or mechanical, then that's a red flag. You don't start meditating, don't start applying your technique if that's your state of mind. So bring to mind, you should have like a database or a collection or which you can vary at will, reflections that bring up inspiration and energy. So it might be sankhanusati, it might be recollecting great teachers and reminding ourselves that they became such wonderful human beings, wonderful teachings through effort, that they didn't start off that way. They achieved what they achieved through practice of the Eightfold Path, through applying themselves. Or it might be the reflection that the Lord Buddha taught us, that as long as there's defilement in the mind, there will always be dukkha. No matter how well we set things up, whether we have full of gains and status and pleasure and praise and all the worldly dhammas are all lined up, everything's going well, but we'll sabotage it, we'll make a mess of it, we'll screw it up somehow or other, as long as there's defilement in the mind. There's nothing out there which can give us true happiness if we still have defilement in our mind. So an analogy, let's say you have some kind of bug in your stomach, and you eat the most delicious foods, nutritious and delicious. And you eat them and they taste nice, but when they And when they come into contact with that bug, then instead of being transformed into energy and proteins and vitamins and all those other good things, it's transformed into blood and mucus. Nothing wrong with the food. It's the problem is with the bug. So we've got this bug inside. It's a bug of defilement. And that can distort and disrupt and undermine and make a mess of everything, no matter how good. So this is the hypothesis we have. So if that's true, and we desire to be happy and at peace, and then we have no choice. We have to find some way of isolating and abandoning defilements. And apart from the practice of meditation, what human activity has ever been devised which is aimed specifically at recognizing and abandoning defilements? Buddhist meditation is the only activity which is aimed at the protection against the abandonment of the unwholesome, the cultivation of the wholesome, the purification of the mind. So if we are sincere in our dedication to abandoning the unwholesome, cultivating the wholesome, purifying the mind, then how can we not apply ourselves to meditation? This is the most effective, most penetrative way of looking at the mind and sorting the mind out and educating the mind. So that's a bit long-winded, but the essence is really seeing how important it is to meditate, and that there's no liberation without this direct face-to-face encounter with the real world of the five khandhas. There's no alternative. So sitting and walking is not it. That's not the whole practice. But it's taking the essential elements of the practice for enlightenment and creating an artificial situation in which you minimize as far as possible all the obstructive factors and maximize the supportive factors. So this is an example I'm giving you of a way just to bring up that kind of enthusiasm. Because if you can arouse that enthusiasm at the beginning of a meditation session, it's so much more powerful. So find the reflection, the teaching that works for you, that brings up that kind of enthusiasm, interest, deep interest in what is this? What is this real world of the five khandhas? So peeling away all the layers of thought and memory and imagination and what's really going on here. So another observation I've had, is that what we call good qualities, virtues, are the natural expression of clear seeing. So in Thailand now, this is kind of like a crisis. Oh, there's always a crisis. This is just one of the crises, latest crisis, of young people rejecting the idea of filial piety and a debt of gratitude to parents. And for me, it's more a consequence of an incompetent teaching of this virtue and this idea you should be grateful. A good person is grateful to this sort of you should, you shouldn't way of teaching. It's really not very effective or necessary. So for me, you want your children to recognize the debt of gratitude to parents, then just encourage them to review their life. How did you get to where you are now? They've all started with one very simple reflection. What would you think would be the absolute worst kind of handicap to grow up with? So we know there are all kinds of terrible obstructions and ways that young people can suffer. But I would say that the worst would be inability to understand, inability to express your thoughts, your feelings. Just imagine you live in a world where you couldn't understand what anybody was saying to you, and you couldn't express, you had no language. So the absence of language would be, for me, that would be like the worst possible thing. And so the possession of language is the most wonderful thing. And where does that come from? And we weren't born with the ability to speak and to understand what the people around us is. And we have this phrase, don't we, in every language, is like, my mother tongue. Yeah, you got it from your parents before anyone else. The fact that you could speak, the fact that you could think. You know, if you consider yourself, I'm a smart person, you know. I think things out for myself. You know, this is a classic kind of deluded phrase, I'm a self-made man or woman. You know, what could be more deluded than that, you know. Okay, you're smart, you can think well. Well, thinking, you use language, don't you? That's the tool of thought. Well, where did the language come from? You know, you weren't born with it. It's a gift. You were given it by your parents and your teachers. And the very fact that you're alive to think, you know, we're not like animals and birds, you know, spend the first few hours or minutes with your mum and dad and then you're off on your own, you know. Go and get a worm for yourself. You have to be with your parents for years before you're capable of looking after yourself. So this kind of reflection just about life and how we are even surviving, to what are the causes and conditions for you being alive and healthy right now, being able to function, being able to think, being able to talk. What is there in your life that you value, that is something that you cherish and value, which you gained purely on your own efforts without anyone else helping you in any way? There's nothing. So the more that you think about, you recollect, you consider your life, the more grateful you feel. So it's not like gratitude is this good quality that you should have, and if you don't, you're a bad person. But gratitude is the expression of a sensitive, reflective mind, which is open to considering all of the causes and conditions that have led up to the present moment. And so there are so many of these authentic virtues. Yeah. They're not things that you can will into existence. They say humility. You say. Often humility is just a form of conceit. We have the Buddhist profound teaching on three kinds of conceit. You have the conceit, I'm better than you, I'm superior to you. And then, so that's like one kind of conceit. But the conceit that I'm worse than you are, that's also a kind of conceit, because it's a self-based view. It's this idea of this independent, self-existent entity who's inferior. And then the third kind of conceit, and one which tends to be invisible in a country like America or Britain, is like the idea, I'm as good as you are. No one's any better than I am. We're all equal. That's also a form of conceit, and it's based upon an idea of self. But when we're looking more and more closely at the mind, then those self-based perceptions fall away. They're not being supported in this. So the idea of being better than somebody else, being inferior to somebody else, being equal to somebody else, they just don't arise in the mind. So, and then there's a genuine humility arises. So there's a false kind of humility and there's a true humility. So it reminded me of a story when I was after my fifth pansar, I went off on walking on Tudong in the north of Thailand, and the end of the Tudong was in Chiang Mai, and it turned out that there was a group of lay people who I'd met before, who'd been practicing at Wat Nanachat, who at this time were living in Chiang Mai, and they knew that I was coming to Chiang Mai, and they invited me to go because they were the disciples of a teacher, and they were so excited about this teacher that they really wanted me to meet him. And he was an elderly monk, originally from Cambodia, but his whole teaching method was to gather a kind of a coterie of people around him, a clique. It was a bit cultish, and he was very against chanting and sitting meditation, and it was like two things, two practices. One was walking meditation, and the other was like Dhamma combat or Dhamma conversation, where he kind of interrogate you and you go backwards and forwards. So I went to spend the night there, and so he started criticizing Lumpu Man and all of the teachers in the Thai forest tradition, and claiming that they weren't actually arahants, that they had wrong view, they didn't really know, and he was so articulate and so confident and so sort of powerful person, you know. And I didn't like him very much. The following day I left, and I was going down to visit Ajahn Buddhadasa in Sun Mo. I'd previously translated a book for him, and I think it was his 80th birthday. I can't remember now, a long time ago. But I got down to Sun Mo and to his monastery, and I was talking with him privately, and I said, "How do you know? You know, when it's a teacher who's so senior and like so many years of practice behind him, and so many people look up to him, and he claims that he knows, and that all the teachers that you look up to and revere don't really know. So how do you know? When you don't have the psychic powers, or you don't have the ability to be able to evaluate this." And Ajahn Buddhadasa gave this really simple but wonderful advice. He said that anybody who lifts himself up and denigrates others is not even a sotapanna. That's one of the things that sotapannas don't do. In Thai language, there is an idiom here. It's like the two things go together, like lifting yourself up and putting other people down. So he was saying, on the basis of that way of talking about other teachers, then you can know that he's not really what he thinks he is. And in the sutta, the Buddha takes up this theme, and he says, if you keep pure precepts, you keep all your five precepts well, but on the basis of that moral purity, you look down on people who don't keep the precepts, and you consider yourself superior to them, your sila is soiled by that. So keeping the precepts purely is not only a matter of not breaking any of the precepts, but not allowing a sense of self to arise based upon that purity. And then the Buddha goes through all these the different levels of practice. You know, even you have samadhi. If you have good samadhi, and then you feel that because you have good samadhi, then you're superior to somebody who doesn't, then you're a fool. So if you're sitting there, you know, like a statue, you know, and you look, oh, look at those people, they're all nodding, and they're all like this. So pathetic, you know, it's like, look at me. It's like, so the Buddha says you're a fool. Even if you've got a really strong mind, you're a fool, you're not a sage. So the true humility comes from looking clearly, learning, and not using experience to create and sustain as being somebody special. We're already all unique, and it doesn't really matter. It's not a big deal. You know, your QR code is slightly different from somebody else's QR code. You know, stand back a few paces, and you can't tell them apart. That's what it is, you know, your uniqueness as a human being. It's really nothing. Don't make a fuss about it. But when you look at the qualities of mind, and the more your practice develops, then the more you feel this very pure and selfless kind of fear of defilement, and this shrinking away from it. It's this sense of shameful. So shame and guilt, different things. And so guilt is, I did this bad thing, therefore I am a bad person. I am a bad person, therefore I do bad things. So that's ignorance and delusion. But shame is, that was a bad thing. That's shameful. So the emphasis is on the action or the thought, not without creating an owner of that action or emotion. It's in creating this false owner of experience that we fall foul of guilt. Shame is a good thing. Guilt is not. So one measure of how we're progressing in practice is whether or not this sense of, well, that's really that defilement, that's really frightening. You know, you follow down that path, that's, you know, you're going to really suffer and you're going to cause other people suffer. It's frightening and it's shameful. You know, how would you want to live with that kind of thought and that kind of mind? And at the same time, just develop this incredible sensitivity to goodness. Have you noticed that as you practice just small acts of goodness? This is so beautiful. And these are one of the fruits of the holy life, or the fruits of practice. You are unmoved by things that would formerly just turn you to jelly or completely upset you for hours or days, you know, and somebody says something nasty or does something that you don't like, you know, and it's like you can't get it out of your head, and your mind's like this. And now you find that you're not, that's weird, that doesn't really, yeah, a little bit maybe, but not very much. Or it's, you know, it's like in a cartoon where somebody's like shoots an arrow and then it just goes right through and goes out, yeah, oh, wow. That arrow went straight through me. How did it do that? It's all, oh, that's what they call ectoplasm or something. It's like, something like that. But you know that how does that work? You know, why? How can that arrow just go straight through? And but that's what happens. So there's this kind of solidity and immovability with regards to loka dhammas, and yet an incredible sensitivity to goodness. You can be brought to tears by just the most mundane acts of kindness. And, you know, I'm going to make confession here, and Ajahn Pasano will back me up on this one. I'm a really lazy person. You know, it's one of the reasons I go and live by myself, so people just can't see. And it's just so distressing for people who can see what a lazy person I am. But there's a good side to it, and that is there is a path of practice specifically for people like me. It's called mudita. It's like, you know, it's so hard doing all these good things, you know. You only have so many hours a day and it's just you and you're sometimes a bit tired, you know. But then you see other people doing good things. You say, wow. Animal tonight, you know. And then somebody else, well, that's so beautiful, that's so inspiring. And oh, look at that. You just got this constant kind of cool stream of inspiration. You don't have to do anything. You just sit back and keep your eyes open. It's amazing. I'm not trying to advocate laziness, but it is definitely, you know, if you're a little bit this way inclined, you're a little bit kind of tired out, you know, it's, I can't really just look around you. Because there's so much goodness, isn't there, when you open your eyes. This is not kind of like, you know, being overly idealistic, head in the cloud, what a wonderful world, and I think to myself, what a wonderful world. It's not like that. There's a lot of misery in the world, but there's so much goodness, small acts of goodness and kindness, and you just become aware of them, and you find you don't even have to make the effort after a while. You just tune into them naturally. You just notice. And this is a great joy in life as a practitioner. And it takes us to one of the great paradoxes of spiritual life is we have this koan in Theravada. So we're all familiar with the, I think, Japanese idea of a koan, where you have a kind of a question or a word which seems like you can work it out, but you can't really, and you just bang your head against it again and again and again till your head explodes, and then wow, and then you understand. So I'm talking about someone who's not actually been in the Zen tradition, but this is my kind of idea of it. But we have this in Theravada, and you know what our koan is? It's a word, and the word is dukkha. That's the Theravada koan. Only an arahant understands what that word means. So in our study and practice of the Four Noble Truths, we don't actually know what this word means. And at the time of the Buddha, monks would be out walking on Tudong and they'd meet members of other sects and they're saying, what are you practicing for? So we're practicing to full comprehension of dukkha. So this is the goal of the holy life, to understand what this word means. What does dukkha mean? And we don't know what it means. So we're constantly looking and learning from experience. And because the comprehension of dukkha, at the moment you comprehend dukkha, there is the abandonment of the cause of dukkha, there is the cessation dukkha, there is the culmination of the Noble Eightfold Path. So we have this koan that we're constantly trying to penetrate and understand through our observation and through our study. And the clearer our minds are, then the closer we get to it. So the point of meditation is that generally our minds, you know, the mind's eye, it's like a windscreen of a car which is clouded over and dirtied. So you want to be cleaning that windscreen so you can see more clearly. And you can say that if you clear your windscreen, then what you can see is more reliable than what you can see when the windscreen is dirty. And this is why meditation is so important. Now, people who don't meditate assume you just meditate to go and into your own little world and escape from the reality, the stressful realities, and just sort of take a break. But it's not. It's to clean the windscreen so you can see things more clearly. And so what happens when you clean the windscreen, when you put down all these ideas about who you are and your passions and your dreams and all this kind of stuff, and you say, what's going on here? And you see impermanence. That's the most obvious thing you see when your mind is clearer. Your relationship to defilement changes, hiriyotapa arises, you become more impervious and unmoved by worldly dhammas, you become more sensitive to, appreciative of goodness. You see how things arise and pass away. Everything changes. And then from everything changes, you see that everything cannot not change. That's dukkha as a characteristic. Everything changes. Everything cannot not change. It has to change. It has no choice. Everything is fundamentally unstable, inherently unstable, unreliable. This is the dukkha that we begin to see. So if everything's changing, everything's unstable, nothing's reliable, there's no firm ground to be found in samsara, then where can we say that's a self, that there's something that is the owner of experience? The very first Buddhist book I read had one of the most profound teachings, and one which I still reflect upon to this day. And the teaching was how we are fooled by our language, and how the requirements of the grammar of our language persuade us that the real world corresponds to those rules. So what I mean by that is we take a sentence such as "it is raining." So an English sentence, we have to have a subject, a verb, an object, and the assumption that we make is that the real world consists of subjects, objects, and verbs. But then when we ask a question in the sentence, "it is raining," what is the "it" which is raining? And so we say, I'm tall, I'm short, I'm happy, I'm unhappy, I remember, I don't remember, I think, I like, I don't like, I can hear, I can see. And so the logic of our language tells us that there is an I who is the unchanging focal point, or the owner of all these qualities. And then we say, well, what is the I? And then we say, actually, the body is short or tall. There is pleasant, unpleasant feeling. There is perception arising, passing away. There's memory arising and passing away. There is thought arising and passing away. There's liking arising and passing away. Dislike arising. Emotion arising and passing away. Sense consciousness arising and passing away. So where is there a space for this I, this independent entity, who the owner of experience? And Lumpur Cha, with his very simple way, said, if this body was you, you could tell it, don't get old, don't get sick, don't die, but you can't. But because we have this like a window of opportunity, this is what fools us as well. So like with breathing, you can decide as an act of will to hold your breath, can't you? You can hold your breath. But how long can you do it? You can only do it as long as nature allows you. But because there is that little kind of window to express will and see how something responds to will, that the idea of self becomes so strong. So a lot of us, if you're an educated person, then you tend to identify with thinking a lot. But can you tell me what you'll be thinking this time tomorrow? No. What about in an hour's time? No. What about in 5 minutes' time? Can anybody guarantee what their next thought is going to be? No, you can't, you see. And yesterday, or today, Lumpur Pasana was talking about, well, how we make decisions, where, you know, you sort of think about pros and cons, and then you think you're being very rational, and in the end you just get fed up with it, and yeah, just go with that one. And if you, so of all the operations of thought, the one which seems to be most kind of indicative of a thinker, decision-making is probably the one. But when you look at the how we make decisions, clearly, you know, and honestly, a decision just happens in your mind like a sneeze, basically. You know, so look, and so all these ideas we have about ourselves and our you know, being as in ground up with thinking. And so coming back to a point I made, this is why samadhi is so important if you're a thinker, because samadhi is the experience of being fully alive, clear and bright in a way that, you know, is unimaginably, and yet there's no thought in the mind. And so experiencing that kind of clarity and that knowing, that pure knowing, which is not caught up with the thinking, and just seeing that you can unlink them, that they're not one and the same thing. Again, that's a samatha experience, if you like, or a samadhi experience, but afterwards you review this. Wow, you know, what's that telling me about who I think I am? Yeah. So thinking arises, passes away, and it's not self. There's no owner to be found. So we're learning how to learn, and we observe that we learn most easily and most reliably in the presence of mindfulness. And when mindfulness is unbroken, continuous, uninterrupted, then certain changes, the sense of stability and brightness and clarity and bliss arise, then the mind is even more, it's at its optimum learning capacity. The Buddha says the benefit of samadhi, yathāpūta yāna dasanā, you can see and hear things according to truth. Without that focused and fully developed sati, which we call samadhi, the mind is still reacting, even subtly, to experience. It's either moving towards it or moving away. And that intensive kind of knee-jerk reaction to phenomena is what prevents insight. So samadhi stills that and allows you to see arising and passing away. These things arise and pass away, and they cannot not arise and pass away, and because of that, there's no owner to be found. And this is how the path of practice progresses. I think I've spoken beyond my allotted time, so I don't come very often, so forgive me for... So I'd like to end the discourse at this point.